head against my neck. I hug him and stroke his ears. I run my hand down his back, and he licks a tear from my cheek as my shoulders begin to tremble. "Stay," I whisper again. "Wait for Thomas. I love you, big dog. You have been a good friend to me. I'm so sorry." I tell my loyal defender goodbye, then shut him inside the bedroom, so he can't follow. Father leads us into the courtyard, carrying Alexei. My brother looks like a toddler, arms wrapped around Father's neck, face buried in his chest, legs hanging limp, utterly exhausted, absolutely trusting. I can feel a fracture beginning deep within my chest, a growing ache that threatens to consume me. Mother is a step behind Father, then my sisters and me, followed by the servants. No one speaks. No one questions Yakov's instructions. We wait quietly on the cobblestones, standing close to one another. Father bends his mouth to Mother's ear and whispers, "We're finally going to get out of this place." The fissure in my chest widens. I want to tell them what is about to happen. I have to. But when I open my mouth to speak, I hear the agonized braying of a dog. It comes from the clearing directly behind the house. I have never heard Jimmy make such a noise in all the years I've owned him. It is an unfamiliar, broken-hearted sound, yet unmistakably his. I listen as he whines and cries and moves farther away into the woods that lead toward the river. The sound grows fainter, and then the night is silent once more. I wait. Certain Yakov will send someone after Thomas and Jimmy, terrified they will be caught.
"This way,"
Yakov says, concerned only with those of us who are in the courtyard. He leads us across the cobblestone, away from the waiting truck, and through another door. On the other side is a narrow hallway, and then a steep staircase. I count each rickety wooden step on the way down. 23. At the bottom is another long hallway, and then a set of double doors at the end. Yakov marches us toward those doors, passing two smaller closed rooms on the way. Inside those rooms, the thump and whisper of men.
"You will wait in there,"
he says, pointing to the double doors at the end of the hall.
"Until the other vehicles arrive. We must all leave together."
Maybe the lie is so egregious to me because I know. Perhaps I would believe him too if I hadn't been warned. I can do the same for them. I can warn them of Yakov's intent. But we have no weapons, no means of escape. There are 10 soldiers on the grounds for every one of us. So I walk into the room with my family, knowing that the only mercy I can extend is the gift of ignorance. And I know it's not enough. The cellar is built into the hillside beneath Ipatiev House, rectangular and damp, lit by a single bulb in the middle of the low ceiling. It is completely empty. I wonder briefly if this is the room where Yakov discovered Maria and Ivan. She's not crying, so I decide it must be one of the other rooms down the hall. We were told that Ivan survived his punishment and is serving a prison sentence for treason 200 kilometers away. But this information came directly from Yakov, and I doubt that even a word of it is true. I doubt that Ivan survived the day. Yakov Yurovsky is not a man who likes leaving witnesses to his cruelty.
"Why are there no chairs in here? Are we no longer allowed to sit?"
Mother's voice drips with anger and arrogance, and of all the things she could say in that moment, it is the least helpful. Yakov's dark eyes are filled with disdain, and I see his true opinion of us then, spoiled, entitled, separated from all reality. He despises everything we are, and everything we represent. He believes that he is doing the world a great service in eliminating us. He hates us entirely. These thoughts are plainly written on his face when he gives Mother an exaggerated bow and says,
I will bring two, one for you and one for the boy.
When the chairs come, Mother drops into the first with the air of a martyr. She presses the back of her hand to her forehead and closes her eyes. It is warm and damp in the cellar, and she fans herself. Father settles Alexei into the second, crouching beside him to make sure he is comfortable. My poor brother. So small and ill and feeble. After a moment, he pulls his knees up and lays his head against them, eyes drooping in exhaustion.
I will go check on the vehicles,
Yakov says. He closes the doors behind him, and I hear the lock slide into place. There is no other way out of the room. Mother sighs. Oh, I hope this doesn't take long. I hate waiting around. There is a unique sort of misery that comes with standing around in the middle of the night after you have been woken from a dead sleep. My mind ticks along two speeds too fast, while my body lags behind, swaying and struggling to stay upright. My sisters lean against the wall while my parents huddle near Alexei. I see Cook reach for Dover's hand, and she weaves her fingers through his. No one speaks, and the only person who even appears nervous is Botkin. He keeps looking at the door with squinted eyes, as though deliberating, and finally moves to stand in front of my brother. I can almost hear the physician's mind making a diagnosis and then desperately trying to think of a solution. He knows. We wait only 10 minutes before the sound of revving engines fills the courtyard outside. I hear the rattle of the lock, then the doors are pushed open, and Yakov steps inside, followed by 11 soldiers. Each of them holds a weapon. Rifles with bayonets attached. Pistols. Several have knives in sheaths at their waists. All of them, except Yakov, are drunk. Semyon is a man who will violate a woman on a train in the middle of the night, but cannot kill her unless he has spent the evening with a bottle of vodka. His eyes, fixed on Olga, are hazed by liquor and drooping at the corners, but still they are filled with regret.
All of you, stand,
Yakov says. My parents and Alexei rise from their chairs, confused. Yakov lifts a piece of paper and reads aloud.
The Presidium of the Ural Regional Soviet has declared you all to be sentenced to death.
Chapter 33. Anna. The Boarding House. 1920, 1919. Schreiber Boarding House, Berlin. February 17th, 1920. Anna wakes to the fading light of early evening. She has slept through the day again. Damn it, damn it, damn it, she thinks, as she throws back the covers and crosses the narrow room to look out the window. The sun hovers above the Rhine, turning the serpentine river gold. It will be dark in an hour. She meant to rise and dress this morning. She had every intention of going about her day as usual. But the nightmares are back, and once again they left her trembling and nauseous for much of the night. Anna remembers laying her head on the pillow as dawn pushed against the sky. She remembers how relieved she was to close her eyes and not see the gory images that have flooded her nightmares for the last 2 years. She remembers how good it felt to drift away into the oblivion of dreamless sleep. But there are consequences to losing another day, and Anna is only now beginning to realize them. Her job, for starters, is certainly forfeited, as is this week's paycheck. She's had the position less than a month, and it was a good fit, too. Needlework at the Müller shirtwaist factory. Anna got the job 15 minutes into her interview when she showed the supervisor her finished work. She and her sisters learned to sew at the insistence of their mother, and it is one of the only marketable skills she has. Anna never meant to keep the job for long. It was simply a means to secure lodgings and buy some time before figuring out what to do next. Scheiße, Anna hisses, stumbling through the pile of clothes on the floor, looking for her skirt and blouse. Without that job, she has no money. There was a loud, aggressive pounding on her bedroom door, and then, Fräulein, are you well? The high, clipped voice of her landlady. Yes, I'm fine. You did not leave your room today. She scrambles for an excuse. I'm feeling poorly. An impatient sigh. Do not forget that rent is due in the morning. And then the woman is gone without another sound. Anna marvels at how quiet the woman is, how she seems to hover above the floor when she walks, with nary a footfall or squeaking floorboard. It's disconcerting. Anna does not have rent money, or money for anything else. Dinner has long since been served and put away. Her landlady is something of a fanatic about mealtimes, but that is little comfort to the rumbling of her stomach. She bought 3 Brötchen last night when she ventured out, but there is only 1 roll left now, stale and wrapped in yesterday's newspaper. It will have to do. Anna chews and swallows the dry bread, chasing it down with tepid water from the jug on her nightstand. She's about to wad the paper up and throw it away when a headline on the front page catches her attention. Princess Irena uses considerable resources to find Imperial family. She drops to the edge of her disheveled bed and smooths the paper over her legs. Anna reads how the sister of Empress Alexandra has appealed to the courts for help investigating the disappearance of the Imperial family. She refuses to believe the rumors that they are dead. She will not believe it, the article says, until she has solid evidence. She will not believe it until she is able to bury her sister. Anna reads the article again. Her eyes drift back to the headline and a paragraph detailing how Irena is offering a reward for information that leads to the Tsar's family. Irena has resources. She is motivated. Anna wonders if she would believe the impossible if it came knocking on her door. An hour later, Anna gathers her clothes and stands before the chipped mirror. She pulls the tattered nightgown over her head and drops it to the floor. She studies her body, the reality of what she is about to present to Princess Irena of Hesse and Bahrain. Hideous scars, many of them still red and puckered. She is fairly certain those will elicit pity. It's the other marks she's worried about. 10 striated lines running vertically beneath her belly button. It's only been a year. The stretch marks have not yet faded to silver. Their meaning is clear. Anna decides that telling her story to Irena is a chance worth taking. Her only other option is being turned into the street first thing in the morning. She dresses quickly, then counts the coins in her skirt pocket. She has enough for the ferry and a bus ticket that will take her through the city. It's only 5 miles. She could walk, but that would take hours. The streets of Berlin are not kind to women who walk alone at night. Decision made, Anna puts the newspaper article in her pocket and leaves the boarding house to find Princess Irena. 11 months earlier. Antonescu Refugee Camp, Bucharest, Romania. January 1919. Anna is not a screamer. She knows that thrashing and shrieking won't stop the pain, nor will it stop the baby from coming. It will only anger the midwife and upset her neighbors in this sprawling, rank tent city. So she sits cross-legged on her thin mattress and rocks back and forth, letting each contraction roll across her body. They're only minutes apart now, and they begin in her lower back as though someone is shoving a branding iron into the base of her spine. They wrap around her abdomen, tightening, squeezing until she is conscious of nothing but pain, until her eyes water and her breath comes in heaving little gasps. And then nothing. The vice releases, and for a few brief, wonderful seconds there is no pain, only exhaustion and a lingering terror that she cannot push aside. But this has been going on since late yesterday, and Anna knows the respite is short. The contractions have slowly increased, coming closer together, giving her less rest in between. She has been riding this wave for 15 hours. "You need to lie down," the midwife says, when the pool of moisture beneath Anna spreads across the mattress. "Your water has broken. It will be soon now." Not soon enough, though, because what she had taken for pain earlier is nothing compared to what is wringing her body now. And she is lost, scared. Her face sweats, but her hands and feet are cold. She is shaking and overwhelmed. She's hungry and thirsty and nauseous all at once. Anna is angry with the women who huddle in the doorway of her tent, drawn by the communal instinct of childbirth. They whisper and shake their heads. She feels their condemnation from 5 feet away. But they know nothing about her and have no right to judge. She wants to scream and order them to leave, but she doesn't have the breath. Anna leans back on her elbows, knees apart, as the midwife scoots her dress up around her swollen belly. She had no idea a part of her could grow so large. It is obscene. It is fascinating. She hates it, and she is protective of it at once. Anna bears down, and it feels as though her entire body is being turned inside out. "Don't hold your breath," the midwife says. "Try to relax." Anna releases a guttural, furious growl and a string of profanities that make the midwife laugh. "Much better." There is no break between contractions now. They come one after another, wave upon wave, each more intense and painful than the last. She drops her head to the mattress. Two of the women move forward to hold her legs. They mutter calming maternal things as she weeps and tries to catch her breath. Above her, the tent is translucent, letting a watery brown light in through the dirty canvas. She counts the stitches in the seams. The midwife goes quiet, working quickly now to mop up the growing mess between Anna's legs. "What's wrong?" one of the attendants asks. "Too much blood," the midwife mutters. "She's very small. She needs to get this baby out quickly." They urge her to push harder, and she does. Anna pushes until the edges of her vision blur and her lips grow numb. "Better," the midwife says. "Now do it again." She does this a dozen times. After a while, she can no longer keep her eyes open. She cannot lift her arms. Again and again and again, Anna pushes until her entire body convulses with one last spasm, and then she feels a whoosh and release. Her legs are set gently on the mattress, and the women who have tended her now move to help the midwife. Their voices blend together in a jumble of words that she disregards entirely when she hears a tiny, helpless squall. It is so timid and weak, and her entire being is pulled toward the sound. She feels tugging and wiping and pushing as this little stranger who has taken her body hostage is separated from her completely. "It is a boy," the midwife says, but not to Anna. "Wrap him. Take him to the nurse. The social worker will be here soon." Anna tries to protest, but can only get out a single word. "No." They have not discussed this. She has not given consent. Anna has not even seen the child, and he is already gone, the tent flaps falling back into place, a cold breath of wind on her bare skin. She is dizzy, exhausted, but still Anna tries to struggle into a sitting position. The midwife sets a firm hand against her breastbone and pushes her back to the mattress. "Stay still. I have to sew you up. You've lost a lot of blood." Another word, all that she can manage. "Baby." There is genuine pity in the midwife's voice when she answers. "You didn't really think you could keep him, did you? An unmarried woman? Abandoned? Penniless? It is better this way. He will be given to a family that will care for him. Don't worry. He will never remember where he came from." "But I will remember," Anna thinks, as her eyes grow heavy and her limbs become weak. "I will always remember."
Chapter 34. Anastasia. The Firing Squad. 1918. Ipatiev House, Ekaterinburg, Russia. July 17th. 2:45 a.m. Knowing doesn't stop the hysteria. I feel the panic hit my bloodstream in a hard, cold rush, first freezing my body, then turning it to liquid. My knees buckle, and I reach for the wall. The cellar fills with a chorus of no, as everyone shakes their heads and wails. Father steps forward and demands,
"What do you mean? This?"
Yakov says without further explanation. He simply draws the pistol from the holster at his side, aims it at Father's chest, and fires. The gunshot in the small room is like the sound of a cannon being fired within my skull. And then the world erupts in violence. It is a direct hit to the heart, and Father drops to his knees. I am glad that I stand off to the side and cannot see his face. I don't want to know what passes across it in his final moment. Yakov's shot wakes the soldiers from their stupor, and they too turn their guns on Father, firing madly. Botkin, Trupp, and Cook are caught in the volley of bullets, and I see each of them fall, torn open by gunfire. They fire, and they fire. The room fills with smoke, and the acrid scent of gunpowder. Chunks of plaster and splinters of wood explode from the wall behind us, and I crouch, screaming in my corner with Olga and Tatiana beside me. We are unable to move, unable to look away. There is no end to the bloodshed. Yakov turns and fires, point blank, at Mother. Her head snaps back and she drops into her chair, then folds sideways onto the floor in a heap. The back of her head is gone entirely, and the jeweled hair clip she always wears rests on the floor beside her, covered in bits of things I don't want to name. When Yakov and Semyon turn their pistols on Alexei, the fissure in my chest rips apart completely. I want to close my eyes, to press my hands over my ears, but my body will not respond. I cannot turn away, nor can I hear the sound of my own screaming above the gunfire. I watch my brother fall, and I die 100 deaths in the time it takes him to hit the floor. Maria is gone, a single dark hole in her forehead. Her round blue eyes are open, staring blankly at Mother, as though pleading for forgiveness, eyelashes still wet with tears. Two of the soldiers stand there gaping at the carnage, and then fall to their knees, vomiting. Tatiana and Olga tremble violently as Yakov leads Semyon toward us. We scramble backward until we reach the wall, and then we watch them draw closer through the smoke. There is moaning and crying on the other side of the room. A man, Botkin maybe. His misery is dispatched with a single gunshot. Dova wakes at the sound and pushes herself onto her hands and knees. She is bleeding everywhere. One of her ears is gone. Three fingers on her right hand are missing, but she stands anyway. A soldier fires, but his gun is empty. So he goes after her with his bayonet, stabbing her repeatedly as she runs along the wall. Yakov stops to watch the horrific scene, head tilted to the side, curious about how she could still be alive. By the time Dova falls, the soldier is sweating, and then he too bends over and retches onto the bloody, gore-covered floor. "Please," Olga says, reaching a hand toward Semyon. She sounds like a tiny, frightened bird. "I will do anything. Just don't kill me."
"Shoot her,"
Yakov says. Semyon looks ill. His eyes are wet and glassy, and he's sweating. Semyon gags twice, but presses the back of his hand against his mouth, then lifts his rifle and sets it against his shoulder. He takes a deep breath. His eyes are focused, not on her face, but on the wall behind her.
"No."
Olga shakes her head, begins to sob.
"Don't."
I do not beg, as Yakov raises his pistol. But neither do I watch. I close my eyes and wait, hoping for instant darkness. They fire. It sounds like tiny bombs going off beside my ears, and it feels like a punch in the ribs. One after another, each knocking the breath from my lungs. I feel others tear through my upper arms and my thigh, the side of my neck, my collarbone, but nothing pierces the corsets. Mother's ridiculous jewels form a diamond-hard barrier that protects my heart and lungs. Tatiana gurgles beside me. Her eyes are desperate as she presses her hands to the wound in her neck. Blood pours through her fingers and down her blouse, unstoppable, unrelenting. And I see her life drain away with each frantic pump of her heart. Seconds later, she is gone, without a word, collapsed to the floor beside me. My eyes sting, my lungs hurt, and I can't get a full breath. My ribs are broken. I taste smoke and dirt and blood. I hear the dying last breaths of those I love. When I reach for Olga's hand, she does not squeeze it back. It lays limp in mine, slick with blood. Yakov stares at me, disbelieving, then points his pistol at my head and pulls the trigger again. A vacant click as the hammer strikes air. The gun is empty, but he tries again and again, furious. On the fourth attempt, he throws the pistol against the wall and yanks a bayonet from the hand of a stupefied soldier who stands looking at the remains of my tiny, helpless brother.
"Why won't you die?"
Yakov screams, then rushes me with a feral howl. I do not think it is mercy that causes him to lift the butt of that rifle and bring it down hard against my temple. I think he does not want me to fight back while he stabs me. The man is exhausted from slaughter, overwhelmed by the sheer work required to kill 11 people. Darkness swallows me immediately, and I'm glad, because it blunts the rise and fall of that bayonet, sparing me every brutal slash of Yakov's blade. But I am not dead. Not yet. And I do not stay unconscious for long.
Chapter 35. Anna. Praying to die. 1918. There is blood everywhere. On her face, her hands, her clothes. It covers the floor and the wall behind her. She can taste it in her mouth and smell it in her hair, like rust and salt and liquid warmth. She can feel it streaming from her body. There is also pain, pain beyond reckoning or explanation. It feels as though someone has pulled white-hot coals from the bowels of hell and placed them at dozens of points along her body. Her temple, her collarbone, in the dip beneath her right shoulder, ribbons of fire on her abdomen and across her thighs, flames sear her calf and her left ankle. The blaze wipes the breath from her lungs and every coherent thought from her mind. "Stop moving," a male voice hisses in her ear, the words distorted as though they come from a great distance. "Stop screaming." Anna doesn't realize she is screaming. She feels the burn in her lungs, the panting, but she can hear nothing except the bizarre, undulating sound of his voice and a faint ringing. It is as though her ears have been stuffed with cotton. "I can't help you if you're screaming. You have to be quiet, please." Again that voice, desperate, begging now. He grips her under the arms and pulls backward, dragging her across the floor, taking her somewhere away from this carnage, away from this blood. Anna is naked, laid out flat on a table in a cold room beneath a single, flickering light bulb. Someone is touching her, running a wet cloth across her wounds, dabbing gently, hesitantly, trying to soak up the blood. "There's so much." It's that same male voice she heard earlier. Moments ago? hours, a lifetime. Time has lost all meaning. The voice is clearer now, panicked. It won't stop. Anna tries to open her eyes, but her lashes are glued together with clumps of something thick and sticky. She sees only a ribbon of light and figures moving within it, male and female, older and younger, steady and unsure.
We have to stitch the wounds.
I don't...
You don't have a choice, the woman admonishes. Her voice has the gravelly sound of someone who is capable of doing what needs to be done. But first we have to remove the debris.
A finger presses against the wound in her thigh, and Anna can feel a little shard of metal slice farther into the muscle.
We'll start with this one. Hand me the tweezers.
The sound that comes rattling up Anna's throat is inhuman and involuntary, animalistic. There are so many places on her body that hurt, 100 fires burning on her skin. But this one suddenly flares to life, bigger than all the others. She can feel the wet, warm trickle of blood slip down her thigh as the tweezers plunge into her flesh and pull the ragged chunk of metal from her body. And then the small clink as it's dropped into a glass.
You have to pick, the woman says, extraction or stitches. I can't do both.
His voice is tremulous when he answers.
Extraction.
Try to keep your hand steady. It will hurt her less that way.
Isn't there anything we can give her?
A snort.
Does this look like a hospital to you?
She's in pain.
She's lucky to be alive, but she won't be for much longer if we don't work quickly.
A warm hand presses against the tiny mound in her belly.
Is this what I think it is?
Yes, the woman says. And then they go to work, prodding her body inch by inch, plucking chunks of metal from muscle and bone. Once each wound is cleared, a needle is pushed through her skin. Perforations and sutures, over and over. At some point, Anna passes out completely. Her body goes limp. Her last thought, a prayer for death.
Chapter 36 Anastasia. The Four Brothers Mine, near Ekaterinburg, Russia, 1918. Thomas was the third soldier who entered our compartment that night on the train as we rattled toward Ekaterinburg. Thomas, who slid the door shut behind him and promised no one would hurt me. Thomas, who risked extending his hand to a ferocious and protective Jimmy.
You can put that paper knife away, he whispered. I know you keep it in your boot. I've seen it. I have a gun and no one can get past that.
Thomas, I had no voice at all, nothing but a wretched, terrified squeak. I saw him shift forward, but he stopped. Thomas very slowly slid the rifle from his shoulder and leaned it against the wall beside my berth. He folded his hands behind his back.
Are you all right, Alexei?
He asked, a muffled sob from the upper bunk.
I think so.
What about Joy?
She's scared.
Are you scared too?
Yes.
There's nothing wrong with being scared, but you're safe now, I promise. Do you believe me?
Alexei didn't answer right away, but finally he said,
I think so.
Are you tired?
Yes.
You can go to sleep. I won't let anyone in this cabin, I promise.
Thomas stood by the door waiting to hear Alexei's breath settle, waiting while my sister's screams turned to muffled cries, and then defeated silence. He stood there waiting for almost an hour, watching me, and only when my brother began to snore did he speak again.
Will you let me hold you? He asked. I hear your teeth chattering. I know you're terrified, and I cannot bear it.
I don't know what to do.
There is nothing you can do, Anastasia. Let me hold you, please.
I nodded. Thomas moved slowly toward the berth. He offered his hand to Jimmy again, asking his permission as well, then scratched him between the ears. Only when Jimmy began to wag his tail did Thomas sit beside me. He pushed the hair away from my face and the tears away from my cheeks.
"I'm so sorry," he said, gently stretching out beside me. "I couldn't stop this."
"It isn't your fault."
"It's wrong," he whispered in my ear, "and I am sorry."
"You've already said that."
"I will say it all night long."
That's when the tears came. Hard, guttural, chest-heaving sobs. The kind of crying that leaves your throat raw and your eyes stinging. Thomas let me come unhinged. He let me wail and beat my fists against his chest. And when I was spent, he wrapped his arms around me and whispered in my ear. He stroked my hair, and he apologized 1,000 times as the night stretched long. Neither of us slept, and we did not talk. Every time I flinched at some noise, he pulled me tighter. Every time one of my sisters cried out in pain, he set his palm over my ear. Every time a soldier laughed in the corridor, he damned them to hell. And twice, when the door to our cabin opened, he flew from my berth and grabbed the drunken soldier by the throat and growled that I was his and he didn't share. We were not bothered again after the second attempt. Thomas waited until the car grew quiet, and then he waited longer, making certain the threat had passed before he slipped away. He did not say goodbye, and I did not thank him because such words were useless. He could only spare one, so he spared me. He saved me that night on the train to Ekaterinburg. But Thomas could not save me tonight, in the cellar. I had my chance. I could have gone with him. It was insanity to stay. I know that. But we would have been discovered sooner or later. Yakov would have stopped at nothing to find me. And the price would have been Thomas's life as well. But he is still alive. And he has Jimmy. That will have to be enough. I am roused again when Yakov and his men begin unloading the bodies from the back of the truck. But I cannot open my eyes. I cannot move. Nor do I know where we are. Dawn will be here soon, and the men are nervous, rushing through their work. Greedy hands rip off my corset in the dark, searching for jewels. Once every bit of treasure has been plundered from our bodies, they drag us, wrapped in sheets, toward the entrance of an old, collapsed mineshaft. It is not ideal, but they are running out of time.
"Just put them in,"
Yakov says.
"We'll come back later and bury them."
My ribs explode in agony when they toss me onto the cold, hard ground. I want to scream, but I can't. Beneath those shattered ribs, one of my lungs has ceased to work entirely, and the other is slowly filling with liquid, gurgling. Every breath shallow, strained, and heavy. The soldiers shuffle away. The truck roars to life. And then I am alone, each breath hard won and coming more slowly than the last. My family is gone. Botkin, Dover, Cook, and Trupp, every one of them dead. And I would think this a great mercy, but for the sound of the cannons in the distance and the barking of a dog nearby.
Chapter 37. Anna. The Munitions Factory. 1918. Anna doesn't mean to drop the grenade. It is cupped in her palm one moment, and the next it is falling in a strange slow arc, tumbling end over end like some sort of dislodged pineapple. She knows that she should reach out and grab it, that she should stop it from smashing to the scuffed concrete floor. But her body is frozen, and her thoughts sluggish, stuck on the telegram she received this morning, and the 2 dozen words that irrevocably altered her life. "The Secretary of War desires me to express his deep regret that your fiancé, Hans Novak, was killed in action in Amiens France, on August 9th. Anna cannot command her limbs to obey the order that her mind is shouting. So she watches the grenade fall, then bounce and skitter, the slim silver pin flying from the arming mechanism. The grenade comes to a stop where her supervisor stands 10 feet away, his back turned, shouting instructions into the busy, clamoring factory. Anna knows that there are 7 seconds from when the pin is dislodged to when the grenade explodes. Yet she does not move, does not speak. It is as though her mind was cleaved upon reading that telegram. One half eerily calm, and the other disintegrating into myriad pieces that ricocheted inside her skull. But between these two halves, a curtain was drawn, and Anna's conscious mind was trapped on the still, quiet side, unable to process the horrific reality that Hans is dead. 6 seconds. Anna pushes against that dense barrier in her mind, but she cannot access the necessary panic or the words to warn her supervisor. She cannot step away or run. Anna walked the 2 miles to the factory today. She donned her cap and apron like she has every day for the last year, stuffed wool in her ears to muffle the incessant rattle and clang of the machinery. She went to her place at the end of the assembly line, and for 2 hours she did her job, unable to think or cry or feel, all emotion muffled, all reality blurred. There was only the work in front of her, the ability to do the next thing. 5 seconds. She may as well hear the tick of a clock in her mind, counting down until the people in front of her are obliterated. Hans was so alive, so warm, so intimate, just a few months ago, pressed against her in the dark, whispering and laughing in her ear, hands exploring all the swells and hollows of her body. He cannot be gone from her. She did not feel his passing. August 9th came and went without so much as a shudder in her soul, without any sense that he had slipped away. How could she not have known? It shouldn't be possible. And yet, somehow it is. Hans is dead, and he will never know that she carries his child, that a piece of him has taken root inside of her. 4 seconds. She tries to speak, but still the words do not come. So Anna did her job all morning, and then she lifted the grenade from its place within the assembly wheel and checked the safety mechanisms, striker, lever, and pin. She rolled it over in her hand, examining the compact metal ball. It was identical to the others, except for the fact that the triggering pin was loose, pulled an inch out from the shell. 3 seconds. She lifts her hand, tries to wave, tries to get her supervisor's attention. When Anna first noticed the loose pin, she looked around the room for her supervisor. That is protocol. He is the only person on the floor who is allowed to reset the pin. In all the time that Anna has worked here, he has had to do it only 3 times, and never for her. But just as her supervisor's name formed on her tongue, there was a nudge deep within her, a gentle, prodding poke, an acknowledgement of existence, not so much a kick, but a greeting. Hans's child saying hello. She gasped. The grenade fell from her hand. 2 seconds. The curtain in her mind shudders and splits apart at the realization that she, too, is about to die. Hans's child is about to die. There is no time to run or scream or hide. No time to pray. The only thing she can do before her entire field of vision detonates into blinding white light is fold in upon herself and press her hands against the small, firm swell of her belly. Hellfire. Thunder. Shrapnel. A cloud of red as her supervisor is eviscerated before her eyes. Franziska Annalie Schranzkowska is blown backward into the wall, jagged bits of metal ripping into her temple, torso, and thighs. I told you so. Oh, don't look at me like that. I never promised you a happy ending. I have lived long enough to know that such things do not exist. In the end, there is only the truth. And it isn't my fault that you don't like it very much. I warned you about this at the beginning. I said you might not forgive me. But you insisted on hearing this story anyway. Everyone does. You're all so enamored with the legend. Yet here is what you and all the others failed to understand. There would be no legend without me. I am the one who stopped her from being a tragic little footnote in history. I kept Anastasia Romanov alive for decades. She needed me. You don't like to hear that, of course. But I did what I did, and I am not sorry for it. Don't you understand what it is to suddenly know that everything is lost and that you are left entirely alone? Can you see, then, why I persisted down this path? My fiancé dead, my body ruined, my child taken from me. You would have done the same thing in my position. And like me, you would have enjoyed it for a while because it was fun, luxurious, people giving you things, throwing money at you, bowing. This new life so different from anything you've ever known that you become addicted to it. What little guilt you feel is assuaged when you see how desperately they want this fiction to be true. How badly they want their princess to be alive. So you let them take up your cause, to begin fighting your battles. Then, many years later, you wake up and realize it's too late. You can't back out now. Your only choice is to embrace the lie, to become it. You're angry now. I can see it there, written on your face. Good. Now is when you can truly understand what I've been getting at all this time. You have proven my point. I might have told the lie, but you perpetuated it with your irrational hope and your willing suspension of disbelief. Don't you see? You are angry with me, not because I was desperate and broken and wanted more from my life, but because it was just so easy leading you to water. You wanted to believe that I was Anastasia.
Author's Note, read by Ariel Lahan. I never meant to write this book. I am not that girl who has been fascinated with Anastasia Romanov since childhood. Princesses were never my thing. I was turned off by them entirely upon reading The Princess and the Pea in kindergarten. Any girl who complains about a lump in her mattress would not be my first pick for a sleepover. And what else, really, is a novel but a 350-page sleepover? Every book I've ever loved has gone to bed with me at some point in the reading process. Decades later, my aversion to royalty remains intact. For the most part, I have little interest in reading about the aristocracy or the privileged rich. I grew up with dirt floors, kerosene lanterns, and no indoor plumbing. I bathed in rainwater heated on a wood stove. But now I'm grown, and I've made a different life for myself. I live in a normal house in a normal neighborhood, and my children roll their eyes when I tell them I had to shovel snow in the winter just to reach the outhouse. They are not impressed. My husband, however, has seen where I come from, and he understands why my sympathies still lie with the lost, the downtrodden, and the disadvantaged. He would be the first to explain why I am drawn more toward Anna Anderson than to the young Grand Duchess. And that's why I wrote this novel in the end. Because there are two sides to this story. One shimmering with privilege and affluence and nobility, the other blunted by sorrow and privation and neglect. What we forget as a culture is that both stories are worthy of our attention. But I digress. I had another novel in mind when the idea for this book crashed into my life. It was another moment in history, a different mystery in a different part of the world. And I plan to get back to that story at some point, hopefully soon. But this one showed up uninvited and preempted all of my plans. I'm still a bit peeved about it, to be honest. I've never liked being told what to do, and this novel did exactly that. Write me, it demanded. Nope, I replied. Not gonna do it. It dug in its heels. I cussed vociferously, a thing I excel at, though I try not to do so in public. It was unyielding. So I went to my literary agent, the wise and lovely Elizabeth Weed, for backup. I don't have time for this, I said. You don't have time for this, I said. Tell me to get back to work on the other thing that we all agreed I would write next. We need to talk to your editor, she said. It was over at that point, but I still thrashed around a bit for good measure. A token protest. I knew this would be my next novel the moment I read about the German authorities pulling Anna Anderson from that canal in Berlin. She brought me to this story because she was a nobody, Fräulein Unbekannt, Miss Unknown. And God help me, I have a soft spot for nobodies. Little did I know at the time how much trouble she would be and how her name would become my own personal curse word. I invented several in her honor. And how I would wish 1,000 times over that I had chosen to write about the history of barbed wire instead. Anything but this tangled, sentient, malevolent novel. Because of her, I spent the better part of a year up to my armpits in Bolsheviks. Not a thing any decent woman would sign up for. Anna Anderson has been called a cunning psychopath, a vulgar adventuress, and a first-rate actress. In other words, she is perfect fodder for a novel. She has been assigned the role of villain for decades. But I like to think she is misunderstood. I believe there was so much more to her life and her motives than her detractors care to admit. Her supporters are equally blinded by their own opinions, however, and it was nearly impossible to find a resource that did not blatantly try to tell me what to think about her from the outset. So my goal with this book was to let you make up your own mind. I wanted you to see the evidence both sides had to offer, and I wanted you to be unsure all the way through, because that is how Anna's contemporaries felt. They did not have the benefit of history, or DNA, or proof. They only had what sat before them, a scarred, maligned woman with a striking resemblance to Anastasia Romanov. It will come as no surprise to anyone even vaguely familiar with Romanov history that I had to take liberties with this story. I did so primarily because the historical record contains a cast of hundreds, and that is simply untenable for a novel of any sort. Much less one that is already complex and non-linear. I've no time to list all the changes I made, or the reasons for them, but here are a handful, all of them necessary for the sake of clarity and narrative drive. I combined the two Romanov tutors, Charles Sidney Gibbs and Pierre Gilliard, into one man and let him go by the name of Gilliard. I combined the figures of Yakov Sverdlov, the man who gave orders to assassinate the Romanov family, Vasily Yakolev, the man who took control of the Romanov family in Tobolsk, and Yakov Yurovsky, the man who ultimately carried out the orders to slaughter them in Ekaterinburg, into one man, Yakov Yurovsky, simply because I had no easy way of differentiating between so many Yakovs and only room for one besides. This compilation is meant to be a living symbol of the Romanov demise. I gave Evgeny Koblinsky the nickname Leshy, so his character would not get muddled with that of Alexander Kerensky. Koblinsky, Kerensky. I find these Russian names all sound the same. It's damnably confusing to me, so I thought to spare the reader as best I could. The man I call Semyon never existed in real life, though many others like him did. He was simply a means of bridging the three different men who held the family captive during the novel. I am afraid that Anastasia's dog, the sweet, loyal, protective Jimmy, did not survive that night in Ekaterinburg. There are differing accounts of what happened to him, but they all end with his passing. I have a big black dog myself, and I very badly wanted him to live, so I allowed it to happen in print. It's a small deviation from the truth, and I am not sorry for it. You will, however, be delighted to know that Alexei's dog, Joy, did make it out of Ipatiev House alive. She went on to live for many years. A few biographies I turned to again and again while writing I Was Anastasia were The Romanov Sisters by Helen Rappaport, The Romanovs by Simon Sebag Montefiore, The Riddle of Anna Anderson by Peter Kurt, The Last Days of the Romanovs by Helen Rappaport, The Resurrection of the Romanovs by Greg King and Penny Wilson, The Jewels of the Romanovs by Stefano Poppi, Anastasia, The Lost Princess by James Blair Lavelle, and The Romanovs, The Final Chapter by Robert K. Massey. Many of the events and conversations portrayed in this book actually happened, and some of the details used therein were drawn from these books. Among many, many things I learned from them is how the Romanovs lived under house arrest, what jewels they sewed into their clothes. Every corset, coat, camisole, belt, and hat, as Montefiore describes in The Romanovs. How they interacted with servants, how they squandered one of the greatest dynasties on earth, the devastating reality of Alexei's hemophilia. How the family became friends with some of their captors, and, most regrettably, what happened on the train to Ekaterinburg, and also in that cellar on the last night of their lives. I learned about the weather in Ekaterinburg and the garden at Alexander Palace. I learned about Anna Anderson's wedding and her visits with Maria Rasputin. At times, when appropriate, I used actual bits of dialogue drawn from these biographies, usually as recorded in letters. This was particularly true with the Anna Anderson biographies. Her friends and supporters kept meticulous records and were more than willing to speak to the press. Sometimes I included newspaper clippings, excerpts from letters, or court verdicts. Sometimes I drew details from the correspondence of the Romanov servants and used it to add color and authenticity to the narrative. One such example is a line in chapter 16, where Anastasia says that their days took on a pattern of frost, thaw, sunshine, and darkness. This is something Anna Demidova, the character I call Dova, because another Anna would have been too confusing, wrote in a letter to a friend in November of 1917. I took the liberty of using it and attributing it to Anastasia. I wanted to present their situation as authentically as possible. Anastasia's nickname, the pets' names, the small rivalries within the family. It's all accurate and drawn from these resources. The Romanovs themselves were all prolific letter writers. Their lives, clothes, personalities, habits, health issues, and opinions are all well documented. However, I used only that which suited my story, and any proper historian will note that I've left out far more than I've included. I was interested only in the last 18 months of their lives, as seen through the eyes of one teenage girl who had lived a privileged, sheltered life. A narrow focus, to be sure, but necessary to get to the heart of this particular story. Any mischaracterizations, mistakes, or omissions are my fault entirely. I am an enthusiast, not an expert, and I am sorry for all the things I've no doubt gotten wrong. Writing about the Romanovs is a bit like playing with a bag of feral cats. It is worth noting that I read all the Anna Anderson biographies backward, from last chapter to first, so I would remain a little off balance while writing the book. It is admittedly a strange way to research a novel, but in this case it helped me keep the mental framework needed to maintain the structure of this book. a structure that, for the record, felt a bit like juggling chainsaws. Only the chainsaws are on fire, and you're blindfolded. And speaking of the structure, thank you for sticking with me. I know